This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of OCD with a guest who is revisiting us called Lily Bailey, who was actually one of the first people I ever interviewed on the podcast back in episode 8, and indeed was the first person I ever interviewed remotely, because most of my interviews back then were in person. So it was nice to catch up over Zoom, not Skype this time, have got our technology together. The audio quality is transformatively different, I would say. And it was so lovely to catch up with her and delve back into talking all things OCD with all the additional insights that 4 years can give you. And so that's probably all the background you need on this interview. It's a really good one for delving into a lot of the layers of OCD and how much it can vary from person to person. You know, it's such an important part of the conversation. We also touch on medication, different types of therapy. There's a lot. There's a lot packed into an episode that is also a pretty good introduction to OCD if you're new to the show, or if you want to pass this on to someone in your life that could do with understanding a bit better, perhaps. Is that a polite way of phrasing it? And another thing to mention before we get into the interview today is the People's Choice Podcast Awards, which you'll hopefully remember we have been up for in the past, and we've even won in the past thrice so far. And so we're potentially up for the health category again. And this is really important to the show. It is not like a vanity project. This is really a big part of how our show has become so well known and so established, is the kind of critical acclaim we've been able to garner. And the People's Choice Podcast Awards has been a major part of that. And having won 3 years already, if the subplot here is if you win 5 years, then the category gets named after your show and you're not allowed to apply for it anymore. And so that would be a really wonderful completionist thing, but more so, it would be so exciting to have a health category for the longest running podcast awards be named after a mental health podcast. That would be so wonderful to see. And, you know, beyond that, helps bring so many new people to the show, helps expand the anti-stigma work that we do here, and we're all about the cause. So if you are up for supporting, it's a quick and free thing to do. You just head to podcastawards.com and there'll be an option to nominate shows there. So we're in the health category again, and if enough people put us forward to be nominated, that's how we get shortlisted and hopefully go even further than that. So you just go to podcastawards.com to nominate us. You can, of course, nominate in other categories if you want to, but it's not essential. It's totally up to you. I'll include a link for that in the episode description. And yeah, that's all I'll say for now. But as always, thank you for your support. And we really do have such wonderful listeners. It's something I'm getting really into, getting to, you know, really chat to you guys directly. Whilst I actually just stare at wavelengths on a screen of myself talking and try not to get paranoid about, like, every time I take a breath, there's a little gap and it feels like pressure to fill. But anyway, it's a peek behind the curtain of, yeah, recording on my own, but I'm getting into it. And so, yeah, thank you for being here. It turns out Lily has been listening to the show since I interviewed her. So that was a really lovely thing to learn today. And learn so much from her, as I always do. So please enjoy this wonderful conversation with the wonderful Lily Bailey in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Lily Bailey. And when people ask me what my first experience of mental illness is, sometimes I find it quite hard to pinpoint or give even a specific example, because I often say that I feel like I came out of the womb with this stuff. And what I mean by that is that in my living memory, I don't know when this stuff started. I just feel like I always had a sense within me that something bad was going to happen or had happened, and that it was within my control to try and stop that or fix it, be that something bad, like externally in the world, or something bad in my family, like a family member dying, or even something bad that I had done, like having a weird thought, like I want my dog to die, which obviously I didn't, that filled me with horror. And then feeling like I had to do sort of some kind of physical compulsion, like tapping my feet in a certain way or praying or sort of repeating a mental phrase in my head to make that thought go away. And I used to actually think that everyone thought like this and was having these thought processes constantly. And as I got a bit older, say maybe sort of 9 or 10, I think I started to think, how's anyone getting anything done? Because this just takes so much time. But I really, because it just, it was how I'd always thought, and obsessions and compulsions were just so ingrained in my way of thinking and being, that I really just thought that everyone was having the same mental processes as me.
Yeah. And I think that's so common, that we just assume that people are like us when we're little. And in a way, I guess we're biased because we're around, you know, family usually. And so we're around the first people that are similar to us in so many ways.
Yes.
And yet when I've like read your first book where you talk about this, and when I've talked to you in the past, the level of the intrusive thoughts and the compulsions and how much time that took up truly blows my mind, that I totally understand what you're saying. But also it's, yeah, it just is so, I think I said to you before, it's so exhausting.
Yeah, well, I feel the same way about myself, and also often when other people describe that similar process, because it's almost like when you reflect back on that stuff, it's almost like, I wonder how I did it. I mean, to be honest, in the end, I did end up having a sort of like a crisis breakdown point when I was about 16, but I think part of me thinks, why did that, how could that not have happened earlier? to live this way and just, as you said, spend so much time engaged in particular behaviours. And so it's like, firstly, how could you think that that was normal? Even though, obviously, as we've said, it's a super common experience. But also, like, just how did you do it? Yeah. And not in a sort of, in a way that we grow up and we have like a level of admiration and care for our younger selves. I know people don't always have that, but that's something I'm trying to work on. And part of me is like sort of strangely, not proud, because, well, proud in a way, because I'm like, I survived that. That was really intense and difficult. But yeah, I wish I had known sooner that not everyone was thinking in the same way as I was, and that I had a quite complex mental illness that really required some treatment.
Yeah. And yet there's part of me that kind of likes that in a way, when we can look back and realise there were things that we did accept about ourselves, even at a time when we've come so far, but there's still so much stigma in the world, that feels like a little bit of the antidote, that if we can still find ways to tap into that and find the balance between, absolutely, we need to get the help and support and we shouldn't be living like that, but also, in many ways, it is understandable that we can find ourselves in those places, and there can be a logic to the logic, even if it wasn't, you know, helping us and we were having fixations on things that weren't real threats. And I know for you, a big part of it came in the evenings, right? That was when you really were going through the mental processes. And could you describe a bit of like what you were working through?
When I was younger, it would be very much in the evenings, it would very much be like compulsive praying to God to sort of like forgive me for my sins and to protect the people around me. And I had like a specific prayer that just went on for such a long time that I would have to repeat. And then I'd have to do that in cycles of 3, and then up that to 9 if that felt wrong, and then up that to 27 if that felt like, you know, that kind of, because people with OCD will often like fixate on a specific number, and mine was 3 and sort of multiples of 3. And then as I got older, I stopped believing in God, but obviously that didn't mean that my OCD just went away. It sort of just morphed. And in a way, like I look at it now and I kind of, it's almost like I was being my own God, like my own like moral, not in a helpful way, in a very sort of toxic and like my own moral, like judge, jury and executioner kind of thing. Like I became my perception of what God had been before, if that makes sense. I would have a list of routines, which would be in the daytime when stuff would go wrong, I would like take a letter that represented the thing I'd done wrong. So say I thought maybe I'd stared at someone's bum and they thought I was a pervert, I'd take the letter B for bum, or say if my stomach gurgled and I was like, oh, I've made a disgusting noise, everyone thinks I'm gross, I'd hit the letter G. And I'd end up with just these lists that were like hundreds of letters long, which I would be repeating in my head at night and analyzing the content of those lists. If it was a red thing, then I would be like, I have to continue to think about it some more. And if it was a green thing, then I could let it go. And then the red things, I'd end up with maybe like 10 to 20 of those a day, but then they'd go onto like a master list. And then like over days, weeks, months, and years, there would like be thousands of items on this list. It was chaos.
Yeah. And do you find ever when you look back on it, there's like a morbid kind of fascination in like the way that you systemized all of this is actually very impressive, but also quite terrifying the extent to which these compulsions were there?
I think this is what I was sort of saying in an inarticulate way earlier. Like it, sometimes I'm just a bit like, I can't believe my brain did that. Like, kind of, wow. But also what I will say is that people often then are like, oh, you must be really good at like memory games and card games. And like,
I was just wondering that.
No, because I think it's like a quite a common thing to like infer based on that. But what I will say is that like OCD just seems to be like so dysfunctional and unhelpful that people will say that these skills just don't usually tend to be transferable. So it's not like, oh, because I remember that I'm really good at, like it's not a sort of like Rain Man situation. OCD is like inherently dysfunctional basically. So I think, but like in order to have those lists, what was driving that was like intense anxiety and fear. And so because that wouldn't really be involved in one of those other tasks, I just don't think it, or my experience is that it doesn't really happen like that. But yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking there, that it came from that place of fear and a level of what felt like necessary obsession. And therefore, if that's removed, it's a totally different process. So it's not you really practicing list making, it's you panicking and trying to make sense of a world you feel overwhelmed by.
Yeah, because people with OCD, and like I know so many people with OCD through my own support group that I used to attend, and then the one that I host now on Twitter, and just the friends I've made. It's an amazing community of people who have OCD, but like it's very often like that sort of morbid fascination you describe. And it's just like people will explain to you the things that their OCD led them to do, like the depths of just like chaos that they were in. And it's just like, wow, you did that. And it's like, and again, it doesn't mean that those skills are transferable. And I think people are often very used to like having people think that about whatever they are compulsive about. But at the same time, the ways in which people's OCD can manifest, the level of just like hours a day it can start to take up, and just like the intensity of whatever behaviors it is that you engage, like it, I'm like over 10 years into being diagnosed and like speaking to people about this very often. And it still never fails to blow my mind when I hear like a new example that someone's giving me.
Yes. And it's so broad in that way. And yet in many ways, it feels like the most stereotyped of mental illnesses at times, that the stereotyping can be so specific of like, it's keeping your pencil straight in a line or something that is so small and so removed from like the majority of the experience. Even if you do have a compulsion like that, the thing that makes this condition make sense and so tough to live with is the emotions and the anxiety processes behind this. It's not about pencils.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, what I'm always saying is there's sort of like an infinite number of ways that OCD can manifest, because you have the obsessive component, which is essentially like the fear that whatever is driving the fear, or the obsessive thoughts you're having, or intrusive thoughts, which can be like, you know, like, oh, like the one I gave earlier, like, oh, what if I killed my dog, or what if I want my dog to die? And so obsessions are just whatever it is that you're worrying about is going to happen, or worrying that you really think, or whatever. And then the compulsive component is like the action that you're taking in response to that, because you feel like it kind of neutralizes or calms that anxiety. But the problem is that then you end up just needing to do another compulsion, and you're stuck in this cycle. Yeah, when you think about it like that, then you realize that basically like a person can obsess over anything. And so it can just be so vast. And that also means that like it can absolutely be about cleanliness and contamination. But it's just so confused because that is the only answer, the only example, sorry, that we seem to have like repeatedly encountered in media about OCD. And even when people do talk about, oh, I'm so OCD about cleanliness or I whatever, like the people who I know who really have OCD around cleanliness and contamination and order and symmetry, so like the sort of things that are more stereotypically talked about, it's so intense and distressing to them. It's not just like, oh, I'm so OCD about my pencil case, I love it when X. It's like terrifying to live that.
Yeah, for sure. And it's part of why it's so offensive to have it reduced down in that way and take out so much of what it is that's so difficult to live with. When we delve into it more, you can find that actually a lot of elements there are more broadly relatable, like having intrusive thoughts is a very human experience. And in a lot of ways, we maybe even just take that for granted. You know, like I've mentioned before that one I'll get sometimes is I'll be like waiting to cross a road and the cars are whizzing past. And there can be that moment where you're like, God, imagine if I just stepped out.
Yeah.
And there's a vast difference for me between times when that's been linked to wanting to harm myself versus times when that's just what feels like a totally random thought out of nowhere. Why did that come up today? And you brush it off just as quickly. And, you know, that's the, I think, a lot of the key for me, that that part is relatable, but then it's how you're responding to that, that a lot of the time you may not even realise you have intrusive thoughts because you think, oh, that's a wacky thing to think, and then get rid of it. But if those monitoring and tracking and responding to those thoughts become your life, how debilitating that can be.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the studies have shown that most people have intrusive thoughts. It's just that they're like, you're described, you're like, oh, that was a weird thought. That doesn't represent me. That's just a sort of floater, if you will. Mm-hmm. And you just sort of let go. Whereas people with OCD, like if their OCD is taking the form of having like really maybe violent or sexual intrusive thoughts, the key is that like, yeah, just like the average person experiencing those thoughts, they're ego dystonic, which means that they don't represent your values or what you want to do. But if you're becoming obsessed with that thought, then the sort of mechanism is, oh my God, why am I having this thought? I shouldn't be having this thought. And that's what like kind of distinguishes someone with OCD from your average person who's having that thought, is that the person with OCD, rather than going down the path of thinking, meh, random thought, they kind of move towards the thought. They're like, why did I have this thought? I have to, and the mental rumination like becomes a compulsion in itself.
Yeah. And that part of it, I guess, has always made sense to me, even as an outsider to that experience, yeah. That if you are finding that fixation, of course you would want to find something to do about it, you know, and in lieu of having other approaches, you know, this is how that can manifest through this condition. And for you then, could you share a little bit about the point at which you got support and what kind of support you got?
Yeah, so when I was about 16, I got to the point where I just stopped wanting to get out of bed because in terms of the lists, any kind of physical action I did, it had got to the point where like that could be something bad. So like I might be worried that when I got out of bed, I moved my arm in a weird way and it looked like, I don't even know what, like maybe I was giving someone the finger or something because of the particular way in which my arm moved. And so that would be like, bam, immediately the content on the list. So I just got to this point where I was like, okay, if I lie very, very still and I do less things wrong, essentially, which is basically a form of like serious avoidance. And avoidance is actually can in itself be a compulsion, but I didn't know that at the time because I didn't even know I had OCD. So I was just like, right, I'm going to lie here. I'm going to sharp shop, just lie here and then nothing bad can happen, which obviously finally people around me were like, that is unusual behavior. And I was made to go for a GP appointment. And I just ended up sort of telling the GP like why I was doing that. And I was really lucky because the GP instantly was like, that's OCD. And actually, like a lot of people have the experience. It's getting significantly better now. And even within the last few years, like it is so much better. GPs have in general, a much better understanding of the different ways OCD can manifest, and they're more likely to pick it up. But it's one of those situations where it does depend on who you see. And if you see a healthcare provider who like is less well informed about OCD and maybe knows more about like the sort of stereotyped compulsions, like the cleaning and tidiness ones I've mentioned, it's not always picked up. But I was lucky, and it was, and I was referred for CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and I did exposure response prevention, which is a type of CBT that's often, well, it's the sort of gold standard therapy that would be prescribed for someone with OCD. And it basically involves exposing yourself to your triggers and whatever it is that you're obsessing about without doing your standard compulsions in response. So I did that for years. And it's been up and down. I mean, I was in therapy for a few years before I had another crisis breakdown moment again and ended up in hospital when I as an inpatient when I was 19. And then I have had more CBT both in the hospital and since then. And I have taken medication also since I was 16. So it's up and down. Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you found the CBT so helpful, because you're right, it's such a great tool to provide you with, well, tools. It's a tool to give you tools and create that safe environment for you to be exposed to those triggers in a way that's kind of managed and will help you feel safer with them. And yeah. I know how powerful that can be for people. Have you also delved into other types of therapy?
Yeah, and I will say quickly about CBT, like CBT particularly at the moment, I feel is sort of, it's having some negativity directed towards it. And I feel like in part that's because it is tending to be the first therapy that is prescribed for everything at the moment if you're going through the NHS. And it's very often becoming like, you know, you get six sessions, it's quite worksheet based, and it's quite, it can feel quite sort of like almost like administrative, like the experience of it, like, right, I'm in, I got given worksheets, we did this and we're out. And I think that that's really sad, because I actually think CBT can be really life-changing. Mm-hmm. But it has to be tailored to the individual, and there has to be a good therapeutic relationship there, and it has to not just feel like a revolving door tick box situation. So I understand some of the frustrations that get leveled at CBT. And I will say that it's not that I necessarily think it's always the best therapy for everything, but it has consistently been shown exposure response prevention for OCD to be really, really helpful and life-changing. So that's why I sort of like wave the CBT ERP flag. There are so many types of mental illness that CBT has been shown to be particularly effective for, but I'm just saying I understand the frustrations level that it also.
I get what you mean. And you're so right to be waving that flag, because it is so transformative for people. And it's understandably the first point of call often when people are referred, because it's also great in crisis situations. It's good for providing people with immediate tools that they can get going with straight away, in a way that, for example, person-centered counselling, which I've had most personal experience of, can often bring up additional things in the early stages that you might have not even known you needed to work on. And so there can be those bumps where it feels like things are getting worse on the way to the progress. Yeah. And if you're already in a crisis phase, actually that could be quite unhelpful.
Right, I agree. Well, I think CBT is really good for when you are in crisis. You need some tools because you're not surviving really on a day-to-day basis. It's an emergency situation. Like, you're not necessarily ready to talk about the really dark and complicated parts of your past and process them. And in fact, I think if I had gone into that type of therapy, first of all, it would have been a disaster. But having had a lot of quite good CBT, I do now see an integrative therapist, and they sort of practice in a psychodynamic and person-centered way. And we are talking a lot more about my past experiences and in a sort of less, like, in a way that's less focused on problem solving, and like it's more just explorative, and I'm finding it amazing. I've been seeing that therapist for a while, but I couldn't have done that without, but if I had tried to do that whilst I was really, really compulsive, it would have been a disaster. No disrespect to my current therapist.
No, I could totally see that. It's, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And there's certain parts of various types of counselling that are quite difficult to describe and make sense of unless you've been through them. And that's one of the things with the more kind of person-centred area, is that a big part of it can be finding problems and learning to be okay with them, learning to be okay with imperfection and not everything making sense and a lot of grey area. And, you know, that can be pretty overwhelming, but it can also be so powerful to get to that place and to realise, like, okay, there's a lot of things that don't make sense and do feel wrong. And strangely, I don't have to react to that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
I'm so glad that you're having such a good time with therapy. I actually share this with you because I mentioned it before to the listeners. I have been considering recently wrapping up with my counsellor. So I've been with her for 4 years. And, you know, a big part of that is we've already dropped down to every other week. And a lot of the time when I then go to talk to her, I'm listing off a lot of things that I've already resolved. And that can be a pretty good sign that maybe you've got a decent bunch of tools. You know, it's time to spend some time without them and see how you get on. And of course, you know, if I need, I'm very happy to go back, or maybe it's for different kinds of therapies in the future. But I actually, I had that conversation last week.
And how did it go?
She took it well. There was part of me where I like had that fear that you could have around a breakup a little bit. And then I had to keep reminding myself, like, this is a professional. This is a professional is very good at their job. And so, of course, she was understanding. And I think, you know, without directly saying it, I think she had been of a similar conclusion. So we were sort of on the same page and, you know, was reassuring that, you know, she's around. She's not planning to retire anytime soon. So if I do want to come back, you know, that door is open. And it was important for me to hear that. I have my last session this week.
Wow.
So I guess was the week before last. There you go. Apparently memory and timekeeping is not solved.
Both of those are quite an issue for me at the moment. But I feel like it's when you can say to a therapist, I don't think I need to do this anymore. It's a credit to both of you, right? So it's always going to be sad to say goodbye to someone like who has known you so well. But it's also like it's a real achievement to get to the point where you maybe don't need this so much anymore. And I also think that like having a break from therapy and being in the driving seat completely yourself and realizing that actually you can manage and just seeing how you get on without it, I think can be really, really good.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. That's the next step for me, is to be without her and realise how much I am more okay than I used to be. You know, you need a bit of that independence, because that is one of the concerns, that you become reliant on that person. And so it is going to be strange. I feel like I talk about it a lot. Like it's very normalised as a part of my life. So it's going to be strange to not have those sessions, but it feels like progress, and it's nice to share some good news.
Yeah, well done. Congrats on your therapy graduation next week.
I know, it's fun. And like I like sometimes do have, if I mention this to people, then they're like, I don't know, they can almost take it as like, oh, you're so together, you're so sorted. And I'm like, hold on, wait, what did I just tell you? I've been in it 4 years. There's been a lot of work, there's been a lot of tears and me thinking I'm a piece of shit, you know. And so I never want to lose sight of like, it was work, but it is possible, you know. I'm you know, there is no perfection here. It's been bumpy, but I'm glad. And similarly, I know you've had a kind of evolving perspective around medication. And when you first went on it, your parents weren't so keen. And could you share a bit about that and kind of how it's been since?
Yeah, it was tricky for me. When I first started my medication, both my parents were quite anti it. I think that they saw it as a... And I know this is quite a common parental reaction. I think they were just like, my child doesn't need that, you know, and almost maybe like a reflection on their parenting. So that was complicated because I was at 16 and I was a people pleaser and I both wanted to please them and my therapist. And I wasn't even really taking my own sort of how I felt about it into consideration. So I ended up going off medication for a while, mainly because I felt like they didn't approve it. And I actually relapsed quite badly. And I think I've been on medication since that point. Actually, I have maybe a couple of times again tried to come off it. But my experience is that when I try to come off it, things do get worse. So I'm at a point where I feel at the moment it's safest for me to just be on medication. I mean, I would love, I think it's about, you have to weigh up the pros and cons. Mm-hmm. I don't love being on medication because there are side effects of it that I find really difficult to manage and that make me sad. And I think it's really important to talk about that. And that it's not that you have to either be like pro meds and super meds positive or anti-psychiatry and whatever. It's like, I wish we had more nuanced conversations around it, to be honest.
I do really want to pause on that point that you mentioned of like having more nuance, because I think that's important, particularly what the perceived outcome should be, you know, that we know it's not like a fix, you know, it shouldn't ever be seen in that way. Like it's part of a, you know, if you'll pardon the pun, like cocktail of things to support your mental health. Also, the thing that really frustrates me is like thinking this should be a singular approach, right? That if you're pro it, that is in itself a singular perspective, because there are so many people out there that maybe medication is something they expect to be lifelong for them. That's their journey, and other people that they go on and off it. Other people that are looking to go on it once and then, you know, progress for them is not needing to go back on. But there are so many variables, you know, that it is a very individual experience. And so, that in particular is where I find there to be no nuance of like, it's totally okay that the amount of time you're on it can be totally different and totally you.
Yeah. And I just... it often feels like people think that there is, sort of like a one size fits all approach to medication, or that like, if you don't necessarily see yourself on it forever, then you're wrong. Or if you do see yourself on it forever, then you're wrong. And I just think, the place I'm at with it at the moment is I don't know if I'll be on it forever. What I do know is that when I try and come off it, I relapse, and I seem to relapse to almost even worse than I was before I ever went on the medication. So that's something I find a bit confusing.
Yeah, and again, knowing that is still a form of progress, you know, even figuring that out about yourself and having tried to come off it in the past and taken notes on how that goes, you know, is still part of the learning process for you. And you know, and it's up for you to decide with your mental health professionals when you try again. You know, it doesn't have to be
right. And I also think that like, if you end up coming off it but actually it's not working for you, it's a really brave position to be able to take, to be like, okay, well, I'll go back on it then, rather than just being like, no, I've committed to coming off it, like I'm not, like we talk about this in OCD Talk Hour quite a lot, which is the talk hour I run on Twitter, where people will be like, oh, I came off meds and it was really bad and I've ended up going back on and I'm proud of myself for like knowing that it was time to make that decision or whatever. This is no one specific. It's just quite a common, and I've said the same thing myself. Like it's quite a common sort of cycle that people seem to go through. And it's like, like there's no point making yourself completely miserable just for the sake of being able to say that you're doing it without meds. Like, why would you do that to yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Who is it for? And the worry is it's for the stigma.
Yeah.
You know, it's for some of that stuff that we've internalized and soaked up. And something else that I know is so helpful for you, our on Twitter, is support groups. And that's something that I've been thinking about more lately myself, because I've like never explored like group therapy or support groups myself, but I know how impactful it can be. And I know from the work we do at the show, you can't kind of over state, knowing that you're not alone, and that being a physical thing that you can sit with other people and share similar experiences, even if they're from a completely different background to you, and be like, ah, so maybe the things that you experienced when you were little, okay, they weren't what everyone was experiencing. They weren't quote unquote normal, but there can be a beauty in them also being far from unique.
Yeah, yes, definitely. It's like, okay, finally I understand this was very not normal. Not everyone was thinking like this, but these people were, and they really, really get it. And I remember being just so terrified to go to my first support group. I really didn't want to go. And my mum like basically marched me in. And I love that support group so much. I'm so glad I went. And I just don't know where I would be without it. I remember thinking I was going to go in, and this was like sort of like internalized stigma that I guess I had towards people with OCD. I was like, I want to go because they're all going to be sitting on newspaper because they don't want to talk. Like, this is just like based on like stuff I'd seen in films, you know, so they're all going to be sitting on newspaper and they're all going to just be like lining things up and no one's going to be having like violent thoughts about hurting their dog or pushing someone off a balcony. Like, they're not going to understand me. And it's like, I got there and it's like, oh yeah, you're really not that special, which is actually really nice.
Yeah, that could be actually really reassuring. And I think also the part that people can miss is it can be so much easier to be a cheerleader for those people, for other people, yeah, and use that as practice for them doing the same with yourself, that you can go, yeah, and be pleasantly surprised and be like, these people are really cool. And their relatability only adds to that. Maybe, yeah, I'm not a monster.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, that's a really quick way to maybe get to that place in a way that I know certain one-on-one type of support methods maybe don't get you there so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very different experience. Like, I think therapy helped. The CBT I had was really important to, like, tackling the way the compulsions were manifesting, and so that quite like the need to start reducing those, and like that was very important. But more than therapy, I think what the support group did for me was to just make me feel a lot less shame around what I was going through. So I think they offer different strengths. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm sure I probably said it to you when we last spoke, but I'm so glad that you found all these things that have really worked for you. It's always nice to hear. And yeah, and I can tell the kind of evolution of your clarity, like even since interviewing you before. It's really, we were talking off air about how it's been 4 years and it both like,
yeah,
feels like forever, but also partly because of the pandemic feels like we've sort of time warped.
Yes, very much so.
So yeah, good for you. Love it.
Thank you.
And also, as well as doing all this work on yourself, you've also been writing and passing on so much of your learning. So I first want to plug Because We Are Bad, OCD and A Girl Lost in Thought, which was your previous book, which is really wonderful, is truly, I mean this, one of the best bits of mental health writing I've ever consumed. And I, as you might imagine, read a lot of mental health books. And, you know, your storytelling is really great. The way that you convey the visceral, like what it is to live inside your own head in this way. And even the way that you speak with this kind of, here I am trying to think of the literacy term, but you speak of yourself as a multiple person entity. You use we terms a lot to convey in a really great way how this voice in your head was so there and so constant and relentless that it became another character in your life. And so the way you write in that same way, I still remember how powerful that was to read.
Thank you. That really means a lot.
No, I genuinely mean it. And I also have to look forward to your new book. This is your chance. I've read the first one. You plug the one that I haven't read.
My new book is called When I See Blue, and it's a middle grade book, which basically means 9+. I've also, it's been being read by teenagers and adults also who seem to be into it. I personally love reading stuff. It's like young adult or for younger readers. So I'd probably just say 9+. It's about a boy called Ben and he lives with OCD. And I basically wrote it because lots of people were reading Because We Are Bad and being like, when are you going to do one for young people? Or this, my son or my daughter or this young person I have in my life. And I'd also always feel really bad when like I'd speak to like 11-year-olds with OCD or teenagers and they'd be like, can I read Because We Are Bad? And I'd be like, I don't really know if it's appropriate. Like, obviously, like if they were sort of like 14, 15, 16 upwards, it probably is. But like, I just really wanted to write something that, like something like that I would have needed at the time, because I've never saw a character in literature with OCD when I was little. And so, yeah, it's for all the little people out there with noisy brains. And I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, me too. And it's so up my street in terms of that's been a lot of my story as well, in going into the mental health space with so many intentions of altruism and, you know, how we can end stigma. And that remains true, but also realizing that a lot of that is to do with the things that I wished I'd had. You know,
yeah, definitely.
It's very personal. This isn't easy work. And, you know, I'm glad that I have the motivation to do it. And part of that is lived experience. And so, yeah, thank you for all you do. In a moment, we're going to come back with a 10-minute debrief behind the Apple Podcast subscriber paywall. I need to find a quicker way of saying that. I'm going to ask you, I actually haven't decided what I'm going to ask you there yet. So we'll find out together. For now, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.